John chapter 20. A record here of the resurrection of Jesus and his appearances as he was beheld by a number of the disciples and the ladies. Very fascinating passage, especially the way John covers it in comparison to some of the other gospel accounts. He brings in some more interesting details. And when you harmonize all these accounts, you see the whole picture. It's very fascinating. Now, our salvation hinges on two historical events, two things that happened. Christianity is not an ideology that just comes up with this concept of salvation and life, and then it's the concept that you believe in that makes the difference. No, there are two things that happened in history that, if indeed they did not happen, that everything that we believe is baloney. But if they did happen, then everything that we believe has a solid foundation. And it's interesting how steeped in history, of course, it makes sense. God is a God of history. He created us and he has intervened in many times in times past, and especially in the last days, after all the prophets and the Old Testament scriptures led up to the coming of his son, the Messiah, Jesus, all coming up to two events. Now, remember what Jesus said constantly, "My hour is not yet come, my hour is not yet come." He was speaking, of course, we know, and we learned about that significant event of his death, that he would be lifted up, that is, he would be killed, and he would be buried, and then the second significant event would be, as he predicted, he would rise again on the third day. Now, those two events, the death and the resurrection of Jesus, are what we basically put our trust in. We believe what happened, but more than that, we believe the significance of what happened. The historical event will not change whether or not you believe or not. It happened. It's a matter of history. But why it happened is what most people need to be understanding of. The Old Testament builds up as to why we need that vicarious sacrificial death of Jesus on the cross, and the New Testament explains just what it all meant, the significance of it, including the resurrection, because Christianity is revolved around the person of Christ, and particularly those two events, his death and his resurrection. Now, when you hear people today say, "Well, you can't really prove God exists." In fact, there was a leading atheist in the United States a number of years ago who happened to be the leading atheist in America was an Australian. Amazing. But he actually made this statement: "Science does not prove and cannot prove the existence of God. So why would anyone believe in it?" Now, that fallacy in logic is repeated many, many times. The fallacy, of course, is assuming that the only evidence is scientific evidence, which, of course, is very crazy. A number of years ago, there was a man by the name of Jack Kirschke who was actually arrested for the murder of his wife. He tried to say that he was in Las Vegas at the tables at the time, and indeed he did drive to Las Vegas that night, but they believe he did so after the event in order to establish an alibi. He couldn't really establish a clear alibi, didn't have anyone that could verify for him, and so he was tried and convicted. Now, all he really needed in order to establish an alibi was two witnesses. Just two people to say at such and such a time they saw him there. A taxi driver, someone at the tables that remembered on that time he was there, so he could basically say, "I've got two witnesses." Now, those witnesses didn't need to be scientists. They could be high school dropouts, for all that mattered. They could be anybody. But that would basically have been the difference between him languishing in prison for the rest of his life and going free. Legal procedure for determining truth is called cross-examination. It's a way that we can determine whether something happened or not. There were four girls at Wheaton College, a Christian university, who came in late beyond their curfew, and they were asked why, and they, of course, all said, "Well, we had a flat tire." And the dorm overseer didn't know, or how could she know whether they were telling the truth or not? So she sat them, she said, "Why don't you sit here, Mary, and you over here, Alice, and Lily over there, and the other lady over here," and sat them in different places, gave them a piece of paper, and said, "Okay, without looking up from the paper, why don't you tell me which tire was flat?" Which, of course, blew their whole scheme, and they were caught. But again, just a little cross-examination, and you can get to the truth of a matter. Now, some might say, "Well, that's okay for here and now, you know, but that stuff happened, the resurrection happened a long time ago. How can you say that it is a fact?" Well, again, there's such a thing as historical evidence as well. Historical credible evidence. For example, let's take a little test here, how much history you guys know. George Washington cut down a tree. What kind of a tree was it? Cherry tree, okay. How do you know that? How do you know whether that's not a legend? How do you know whether that's indeed, you know, the case? Well, you can do a little historical searching for that. You can find that in the 18th century, through all the documents that were written, not one person ever makes mention of that story. It wasn't in any of his diaries. It wasn't in the records of Congress, not recorded in the Continental Army annals. It was never told to Martha. Nothing was given as far as any information. But in 1975 in the New York Times, there was a leader who quoted the need for the president to say, "Sir, I cannot tell a lie." And of course, he was making reference to George Washington. And then there were other records as they track. You could track back in history. In 1943, there was the quote used. And in 21 and in 1887, they found for the first time that it was written. It came actually from a man by the name of Pearson Reams, who was a fiction writer for children. And he was basically just trying to get children to, you know, speak honestly, and he made the story up. And now it comes down, even in our day, people generally think that happened. But it can be easily tested that it did not indeed. Now, another historical event that took place. George Washington, did he or did he not cross the Delaware? Now, that you can definitely confirm, because it's in his letters, it's in his diaries. It's in the records of Congress. It's in the Continental Army annals. It's even in the British news that on that particular wintry night when the British Army were getting drunk and celebrating Christmas, they were waiting for Santa Claus, and they never expected George Washington to show up. But it is, in fact, based on solid historical evidence, an established fact of history. So there are other ways to establish a fact. Now, when you come to the New Testament documents, the records of what happened, when you go a little deeper and you dig up some of the records of the Dead Sea Scrolls and some of the other writings of the time, when I was in college, everybody really mocked Christians because they said, well, the only place that has any of these cities and people's names and places are all in the Bible, so how can it be accurate? We have no other records of it. Well, now, I mean, you can't even go through the number of records, the references, the old people, the historians have uncovered, the statements they've made in regard to all the different facts. In fact, archaeological finds, you know, the stone what they found Pilate's name on. They used to say Pilate was a fictional character. And you can go over right now and see the replica of it in Caesarea. It's quite fascinating. There he is, Tiberius Pilate, who's dedicating that area to Caesar. And the fascinating thing about this is that people generally don't want to think in terms of something can really be verified. They try to pass it off into the aspect of faith. Well, you just got to believe. No, the point is, in historical records, whether they happened or not can be established as fact. What you believe about those records, in other words, the significance for your life, is what you take by faith. The fact that Jesus died on the cross and rose again is a historical fact that can be verified more than most records in history that we establish as fact. The documents, the evidence, there is not one way that you can actually, in fact, there have been people that have, with their skills of scrutinizing things, in fact, certain lawyers, one particular lawyer, Morrison, I forget his first name, someone help me with that, what was it? Anybody ever know that book, Who Moved the Stone? He determined to show that indeed it could not have happened that Jesus rose from the grave. And he was determined with all his expertise in cross-examination to evaluate all the records and prove that there was a way that it was all a hoax. He got halfway finished with his book and he realized with all the evidence it had to have happened. There was no way that Jesus was not resurrected from the dead. As implausible as it seems, and as hard as it was for him to believe, he couldn't come to any other conclusion. But that is what you understand. That happened. But why it happened is where you take by faith. You understand, he died for me. He rose again to prove that what he did in his death was accepted by God. Because he died as a perfect person for sin, he broke the chains of sin and death. And then death could not hold him. And he was resurrected in power and in glory. So these are things that when you come to this type of just a simple narrative of what happened, if you really put your thinking cap on, you can compare this with the other gospel accounts. You can compare this with other writings in history. In fact, if you really want to dig deep into this, there's a book by F.F. Bruce, a couple of books, one called The Books and the Parchments, and one, The New Testament Documents, Are They Reliable? Excellent resource to do some work in this. But it's important, too, to realize that when you're in college, if maybe you're a university student, professors make all kinds of outlandish statements about things they don't know anything about. They might be specialists in their field in this area, but they'll talk very freely about other things that they really know less than you in many ways. You have to be sharp on that. There are professors even today that still believe that the New Testament documents weren't written until the 4th century. Not a lot of them believe that anymore because of the evidence. But there are still some that are outdated in their knowledge. You know, they're sitting in their ivory towers and they've got their ideas that they want to put forth. But unfortunately, most people aren't looking at the hard sciences anymore, but they're looking at the philosophical ideas. And that's where people get all messed up. Because where you get into the studies that use your imagination, as opposed to the disciplines where in math and science, you're a little more, you know, you take, you know, great pains to keep a disciplined study and in history, you find that people with the philosophical stuff, they get off in all kinds of tangents. So we really need to look at this from a standpoint of this simple story in history and put our faith in, well, obviously that it happened in historical fact, but also why it happened for us. Let's, with that long introduction, let's jump in. John chapter 20, verse 1. Now, the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb early, while it was still dark, and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. First day of the week, which would be Sunday, Mary, out of whom Christ cast seven demons. There's a lot of tradition about Mary being a loose woman, a woman of the street. There really isn't any biblical reference to that at all. She was not a prostitute that we know of. That sometimes that all comes from the lore and the tradition that you hear. But biblically, all that was said about her was she had seven demons and Jesus cast them out. And it's amazing. She was the last at the cross there and first at his grave. She was the longest there and the soonest here at the grave just because of the deep love that obviously she had. And of course, it shouldn't surprise us. Jesus said, for whom much is forgiven, or, you know, when someone is forgiven much, they're going to love much. That makes you wonder. For me, it does. As I see Mary Magdalene, I wonder, how is it? Why is it so few Christians have the passion and the devotion to serve the Lord? Are they unaware of what the Lord has done for them? That they have such little appreciation? That they sacrifice so little for him? That they follow him so loosely? That they rarely give of the bounty he's entrusted to them? That they don't have a real strong walk in their, you know, fellowship with the Lord? And you wonder why it is. And maybe it's because they don't think that he's forgiven them much. They can understand people that maybe have come out of really bad backgrounds, how they're so zealous to serve the Lord. But there's this proper, nice Christian who over here thinks, well, I was basically a good person and now I'm a Christian. And there's not that real passion for the Lord. I would submit to you that it's not so much that some are forgiven more than others as it is that some don't realize how much they've been forgiven. The Pharisees were probably the worst sinners of all with their pride and arrogance. And yet they saw themselves as so holy and righteous. Where the tax collectors, the prostitutes, the people of the street really were conscious of their sin. And so when they were forgiven, they were aware, wow, I'm forgiven. And they appreciated it so much more. Mary certainly was in that category. But there was also other people that had all the righteousness of the world, like Paul the Apostle, and he calls himself the chief of sinners. And he was amazed that God would forgive him, and yet he was such a righteous Pharisee, following the law so perfectly as in his own mind, and that he realized when he met Jesus just how far he was. And it gave him a passion to serve the Lord all the more. So Mary comes. John records Mary came and she went to the tomb. Now the other Gospels say there were more than just Mary that were there. And they see John was incorrect. He was not accurate in this. There's a contradiction. But read on. He says, "Then she ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved and said to them, 'They have taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him.'" Who's we? Well, obviously the other women that she was with. The fact that John just records Mary, she stands out in his mind. But there's no contradiction. Obviously, she was there with other women. In fact, when she came and ran and came to Simon Peter, because she saw the stone, apparently what had taken place there, and, you know, well, let's follow this whole line of thought here, what happens with Simon Peter. As she tells them what takes place, you know, Peter and the other disciple whom Jesus loved, which we presume is John, notice what they do. She says, "They've taken away the Lord out of the tomb. We don't know where they have laid him." From her standpoint, he's not there. She's saying this. That's all she knows at this point. Peter, therefore, went out, and the other disciple were going to the tomb. So they both ran together. The other disciple outran Peter and came to the tomb first. Probably younger legs. If it is John the apostle, that he was obviously younger. His dad was still alive. Peter, there's no record of his dad being alive at that time. And, of course, John the apostle outlived all of them to a ripe old age. So we can only surmise he was the younger guy, came to the tomb first, and he, stooping down and looking in, saw the linen clothes lying there, yet he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came following him and went into the tomb, and he saw the linen clothes lying there. So, you know, John outran him, looks in, and he's kind of wondering, that Peter comes after and goes right into the tomb, and he sees the linen clothes, notice, lying there. Now, unfortunately, in the English, you don't find there's two different words here in the Greek for see. It says that John saw, and the word means just perceived. He looked, he perceived. They're not there. That Jesus isn't there. The linen clothes were there. What Peter saw, the word is a different Greek word, which implies he viewed attentively. He was gazing at it. He was pondering it. So John looked and just perceived, wow, what's going on? Peter got it right in there and is studying it. He's looking at it. What happened? Just like you would probably do. You're like, what's going on here? And you're looking at it. You're looking at the stone. You're looking at the linen clothes. You're watching. You're gazing intently at this. Now, in the grave clothes, what he found was quite interesting. It said in verse 7 that the handkerchief had been around his head, not lying with the linen clothes, but folded together in a place by itself. Now, all linen clothes are lying there. These linen wraps that they would wrap the body in. Remember when Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus took the body, wrapped it with what? 100 pounds of spices. Myrrh was the number one spice used. You can track this down. It's quite interesting. But myrrh with linen on the skin almost acts like a cement. When you're wrapped in that, it sticks, it adheres to the body. It's very sticky, it adheres to the linen cloth, it saturates the linen cloth, sticks to your body, and you're literally mummified with this stuff. Now, if someone came and stole the body, which is what has been reported, of course, by the authorities, they figured, well, something happened. It must have been that the disciples came and stole his body. Why would they take all of his clothes off? I mean, it doesn't even make sense. Not to mention the labor of doing it, but you also find there's the Greek word here is that this stuff is lying there and everything is just neatly in order. Now, much more if they stole him and they took his clothes off and then, before we run out of here, fold those clothes over there. Can you imagine that? There's no sense to that. If Jesus wasn't really crucified, but you know, he never really died and he kind of revived, again, unwrapping himself before going out wouldn't be one of the smartest things either. You know, you're wandering around with no clothes on. There's just so many little oddities that don't make sense with this. But more than that, in the language, what you get here and what caused the effect on these disciples was the fact that it says, notice verse 8, the other disciple who came into the tomb first went in also. So after Peter's in there studying, he comes in and joins them, and he saw. And here's another word. There's three words for saw in the Greek. Unfortunately, the English just doesn't get all these. But this word is the word oida, which is one of the words translated most of the time for the word no. There's two Greek words for the word no. And this is important to kind of get this. One word is It's not pronounced this, but just for the sake of phonetic spelling, gnosko. It's a word that simply means to know by experience. You know somebody is a nice person because you've spent some time with them, so you know they're a nice person. The other word is a word that means intuitive knowledge. In other words, you can't put your finger on it. You haven't really experienced it, but you know that you know that you know that is the case. This is the word that he uses here. He hasn't experienced the risen Lord here, but he has believed because intuitively what he's looking at, as he's looking at these grave clothes, he knows there is no other explanation. Now, what would you expect to find if you went into a tomb like that? And indeed, when we go into Israel, it's interesting to go into the garden tomb. It's a tomb that was a rich man's tomb. It has all the aspects. If it's not the tomb, I would be surprised. If it is the tomb, well, people sometimes get really carried off with that as well. But it does provide a very good picture of a tomb of that day that a rich man would have had. It fits the bill. It's an unfinished tomb, which the Bible says that Jesus was laid in an unfinished tomb. In other words, when you go in, there's a compartment there for the wailers, and the mourners. And then there's the compartment where you walk in and there's on the one side, there's like a rock. It's carved out of rock and there's a place for a person there. And the other side is only half carved out. So it's not finished. Jesus apparently, when he was laid there, generally what they would do in these rich man's tombs, of course, then they'd roll the stone over and it would be preserved. And it would take about six men to roll this huge stone to cover the entrance. So basically, people aren't going to go in and start, searching around. Here, Jesus was laid. But when you go into that, picture yourself going into that. What would strike you as the most convincing thing that indeed something miraculous took place? I'll tell you what it would do for me, and it really comes out in the Greek language. Is not if I saw the linen clothes lying all over the place, as if someone was unwrapped, then that would make me suspicious. But if I saw the linen clothes there exactly the way they were when they were on the body, and it was almost as if the body was just taken out of it and you have this little cocoon, now that would freak me out. Knowing how he was buried, knowing how he was, and to see that, I would know he went right through that. He was resurrected. His body came right out of that in a glorious body. And it would definitely have the same effect that John had here. He saw this, and intuitively he realized he is resurrected. This is not, something that could have just taken place. But what's striking is the next verse. But for as yet they did not know the scripture that he must rise again from the dead. Now, how could they have missed that? As many of the times as we saw in this book, as well as the other gospels record, Jesus said it very plainly. On the third day, I'm going to rise. I'm going to be killed. I'm going to be put to death. I'm going to be rising on the third day. He said this many, many times. But unfortunately, the only people that really believed him were his enemies. They believed him, and fascinatingly enough, the chief priests and the Pharisees believed so much so that they actually hired or told Pilate they wanted to guard that tomb. They wanted to put soldiers around it, put a seal on that thing, and make sure his body could not be stolen, because if it got out that Jesus was resurrected, then in their mind, he'd become even more famous. So here are the Pharisees. It's not enough that they killed Jesus. Now they got to guard his dead body. But thank you, Mr. Pharisee. Thank you, Mr. Chief Priest. You actually helped us out quite a bit there. Had they never put that guard there, we would have always wondered what happened. We'd have always wondered, the disciples took his body, most likely. But the very fact that the enemies of the Lord made it so that it made it impossible, the Roman guards guarding the tomb, upon penalty of death, that anyone would come and open that seal. If they fell asleep, penalty of death. Interestingly enough, that the other gospel account records that the chief priests went and they paid off the governor, they paid off some of the officials so the word wouldn't get back to the governor, so that he wouldn't hear about it. So they told the story the disciples stole the body. Now you're a Roman guard, on guard there. And you certainly don't want that story to be circulated, because that's your life. You let that body get out, you're dead. You're a dead man. But somehow or another, they were able to bribe the man that would prosecute them, buy him off so he wouldn't prosecute them, So the soldiers would be protected if the soldiers would agree to lie and say that the body was stolen. Well, hey, they got nothing to lose because they're dead. They're dead anyway because Jesus is gone. They're responsible. No one's going to believe a resurrection. They're dead. So, hey, I'll tell you whatever you want, sir. He lied. Yeah, he stole the body, which is an interesting lie. Let's say you are convinced your neighbor came and stole your television one night. And you said to the judge, as you took him to court, I believe he came in while I was sleeping and stole my television. What's the judge going to say? If you were sleeping, how do you know? I mean, it's very obvious. So the soldiers are saying, he stole the body. They stole the body while we were sleeping. It's so ludicrous. It's not even, it's just unbelievable. But it just goes to show you that all the thing is set up to show that there's no other possibility. And especially with the grave clothes here. But, that's just the beginning. Because there are going to be a number of eyewitness appearances. Now remember, to testify, to establish a fact, all you need is two witnesses. Just two. Well, there are plenty more where those witnesses came from. But understand that when Jesus told the Pharisees the sign, when they asked him, if you're the Son of God, give us a sign, show us a sign. What did he respond to them? No sign will be given to you except the prophet Jonah. As Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the whale, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. But that he would resurrect. He also corresponds that with the statement, remember when they were asking Jesus, of course, to give a sign and to prove who he is. He said, all right, destroy this temple and in 3 days I'll raise it up. And that he spoke of his body. That he had the power to lay it down and the power to raise it up. Now, I defy anyone to show me that trick. Now, you'd be hard-pressed enough to lay your life down, that is, without actually committing suicide. But if that's hard enough, try resurrecting yourself. And not just that you resuscitate and come back to life like Lazarus did. Lazarus was not resurrected in the same way that Jesus was resurrected. Lazarus came back to life and then he died again. When a person is resurrected in the way that Jesus is, and one day we will experience that same resurrection, we will receive a new body. Our old body will be transformed. It's not that the old body is just going to be, out of the picture. It's going to be transformed. Whatever molecules are still left around, the Lord will reform them into that glorious new body that he has designed for us. So here is the resurrection. Here is the facts of the case. Now, let's look a little bit deeper into this. It says the disciples went away to their own homes there. Now, in this, the whole picture of how everything happened here, it's kind of a picture. Let's look at this. First of all, let's look at verse 11. Mary stood outside the tomb weeping. So in other words, when they came back to the tomb, and of course the disciples went away again, Mary had come back with them. She's there outside the tomb weeping. And as she wept, she stooped down and looked into the tomb. And she saw two angels in white sitting, one at the head and one at the other at the feet, where the body of Jesus had lain. And they said to her, woman, why are you weeping? And she said to them, because they have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have lain him. Now when she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there and did not know that it was Jesus. And Jesus said to her, woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking? She, supposing him to be the gardener, said, sir, if you have carried him away, please tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away. And Jesus said to her, Mary. She turned and said to him, Rabboni, which is to say teacher. And Jesus said to her, do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father, but go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, and to my God and your God. And Mary Magdalene came and told the disciples that she had seen the Lord and that he had spoken these things to her. Now, the three different reactions at this empty tomb are quite telling. John believed, it said. Peter wondered. He's still examining this in his mind. He's still pondering this. But Mary stays and is weeping, not understanding, not even remotely imagining the possibility of a resurrection. And here she is weeping, and it's true so often when we have our fears and our worries, and they're usually there because of our limited perceptions and our limited understanding of what God is really up to. And for the most part, our worries and cares and concerns are needless. We always, when we think about worry itself, what does it do? You know, it's not going to add one inch to your stature. If you're worried about being so short, you know, all the worrying in the world is not going to give you any more height. So much of what we worry about can't be changed. The Lord wants us to trust Him. And here she is pondering this, and amazingly, the Lord, then the angels first, you know, speak to her. They're appearing to her. They're saying He's not here. And then she turns and sees Him. Now, He was seen at least 11 times, according to the gospel record. Different times of the day, different ways by different witnesses. First by one woman alone, here Mary. Then by several women together that we will note out. Then by one man. Then by two men. Then all in the open. Then seen by the 11 disciples in a room. Then by 11 again. And then afterwards on five different occasions. One with 500 people at one time, Paul tells us, that he appeared to. Now, people talk about someone had a hallucination. They imagine seeing him. That falls apart as soon as you have one or two people having the same hallucination. That's usually a private matter, especially 500 at one time. You know, they're not going to have the same hallucination. But they touched him, the Bible speaks about. They talked with him. They ate with him and drank with him. Plus, all those who saw him were at first unwilling to believe. They first couldn't believe. It just was too incredible to them. And there was obviously no collusion as a plot put together. And no other event in history is so well reported. Unfortunately, no unbeliever has really looked into the solid historical evidences for the resurrection. And then, of course, you have the change in the apostles' lives a few weeks after the resurrection, how bold and daring they are, where before they were afraid, and how confident and non-hesitating. They were no more afraid to go out and speak the truth. And even the most hardened rationalists who have studied this have in their writings, they are obliged to admit something extraordinary must have happened. They won't admit the resurrection, but they'll say something dramatic took place. Now, as we read this, and maybe you are, maybe you're not familiar with the other gospel accounts on this. And you might have some difficulty because there are some difficulties in harmonizing all these accounts, which makes it all the more amazing because each is telling his story and it's a clear absence of them colluding together and trying to plan this out together. Hey, you know, Mark, you write this and then I'll say the same thing over here. And Luke, and, you know, if they did that, then all the gospel accounts would be kind of like just right on through. But they don't have that. It's like the four different accounts of the life of Jesus. And when you come to the resurrection, you've got the records of the different witnesses saying things. And of course, when you put them all together, some things are hard to piece together. For example, the Bible says that Jesus first appeared to Mary alone. That was the first appearance. Mark tells us that. And if that's the case, and when, as Mark 16:9 says, he first appeared to Mary Magdalene, of whom he had cast out seven demons, you've got a difficulty here because it says, according to the other Gospels, and this is really what's happened, to certain women, then he appeared to certain women returning from the gravesite, then to Simon Peter alone, then the disciples on the road to Emmaus, etc., etc. Now, Matthew says that Mary and the other Mary came to the sepulcher together. They came to the tomb together. They saw an angel, heard that Jesus was risen, and ran to tell the disciples and met Jesus on the way, and both saw him at the same time. It would appear from Matthew's gospel that there's a contradiction. Because Mary was alone, came and told the disciples, then came back, and there it was when, after the other disciples left, that she saw the angels and then she saw Jesus. And Jesus appeared. But here's a very simple solution. Both Marys and other women actually indeed did go on the morning of the resurrection. Several women were present if you compare all the accounts. But as they were getting near, apparently Mary saw the stone rolled away. She left immediately to tell Peter and John. And of course, there's where the record is that we just saw. While she ran off, the other women went into the tomb. They saw the body gone, the vision of the angel who said that Jesus has risen, go tell the disciples. Then they went. In the meantime, Mary came back with Peter and John. So the other women are out telling the other disciples. She came back with Peter and John. They left Mary there, as we see, weeping. She then sees the angel and Jesus herself. And then, at the same, just shortly after that, the other Mary and Salome, on their way, Joanna with another woman, apparently in another direction, Jesus met them after he appeared to Mary. So now here Mary asks where they have laid him. And, of course, she can't conceive of the resurrection. She doesn't recognize him. And then what does Jesus do? he says, Mary. And of course, she realizes it's the teacher. And Jesus then says to her in verse 17, do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father. But go to my brethren and say to them, I'm ascending to my Father and your Father and to my God and your God. Why is it that she can't cling to him? Why is Jesus saying, do not cling to me? When I figure that out, I will let you know. Because I have no clue. We really can only speculate. We don't really know. She doesn't want Mary to rest her faith in any physical apparition or his body. I don't know. Or another factor is, that she'll tell of this experience or embellish it. Or, you know, maybe there are other people that if they don't have that exact experience, you know, we can only speculate. We really don't know. But it's interesting that, you know, his purpose, again, he's going to ascend to the Father. Now, is he referring to the physical ascension here, or is he right away going to go up to the Father? Again, from the writing, it's a little difficult to see how it's being expressed here. But there's a purpose for that. But the really interesting thing is that soon Mary, then with another woman, went to a disciple and told the message of the angel. Now, this is the Mary that came to get Peter and John, but the other Mary, who was at the cross as well, who joined them, she was with Joanna, apparently. And they went, told another disciple the message. But they said, we saw the angel, but didn't see the Lord. So when you read all these accounts, it seems contradictory until you realize that the women came together, but then they separated and they had different experiences of how it happened. You cannot find in this a contradiction. Unless, you know, you're forcing it into the text. Because it does fit very interestingly enough. The Lord then appeared to Simon Peter, who went back after hearing Mary's report. And the same day then Jesus appeared to the many others. Now why is this, you know, when we get into this narrative, why is it so important that John establishes this in such a way? Why is the way this is expressed that this happened? It's not like he's trying to prove anything other than the fact that this is the event of what took place. You judge for yourself. This is what took place. You judge for yourself. But when Mary Magdalene came and told the disciples she had seen the Lord and that he had spoken these things to her, of course, it starts a whole chain reaction where eventually we're going to see Jesus reveals himself to the disciples and Thomas is a particular case. And I want to back up because I don't want to rush away from the whole concept of Mary Magdalene. Because you've got two different contrasts in this chapter, and to spend time to deal with both of them in one setting is a real unfair thing to do. I really want to spend a little time next time looking at a character that probably most of us could identify in one way or another, and that's Thomas's experience, you know, doubting Thomas. Now, again, he provides a good service for us, but what he struggled with is what so many of us struggle with. But Mary herself was the least one to believe at this point, and yet she was there, and the Lord revealed himself. Now, you could ask all kinds of different questions. No, why didn't Jesus, show himself to Peter and John when we were there? Why is it all that? Well, you know what? I don't know why Jesus revealed himself in the way he did. Some ask, why didn't he reveal himself to the whole nation? Why didn't he, get up on the mountain and glow with, luminescence, and let everybody know? Well, the whole point is, he wants us to believe by faith. We've got enough evidence to go on to make a decision. In the same way, the disciples, obviously, when the early church got started, many of the disciples in the early church, the 3,000 that received the Lord on that day of Pentecost, they never had the benefit of actually seeing the risen Lord. But now here they are, believers, and they're changed. Their lives are changed. They know he's real. He's come into their heart. You've never seen the risen Lord, but yet you believe. Mary had the benefit of seeing the risen Lord so that she would be this eyewitness, that we could base our faith on the credibility of their witness. And when you put any one piece, and this is what bothers people about the resurrection and about Jesus' death and the whole thing, any one particular item isn't enough to convince them. Because you could argue each one of these points. Okay, yeah, well, the grave clothes could have been like that, but, it's not really certain. And Mary, she might have had, and we can, each particular item, you could argue. You could basically tear it apart. And you know what happened? There was a particular court case that indeed such things took place. They took each piece of evidence and they tore it down. Then they went to the next piece, tore it down. Went to the next piece, tore it down. How many of you remember the O.J. Simpson trial? Each piece, separately, by itself, there was a question. Well, you know, the gloves are a little bit tight, and maybe they weren't his. Or you know what, that footprint that comes from that particular Italian shoe that very few people have that matches his perfectly could be his, but someone else just might have had that particular Italian footprint in the blood there at the scene of the crime. And over here, and you could look at each particular item, and you could create that reasonable doubt in people's minds. And what happened, the jury, I believe, is they began to doubt each one. And once they would knock one piece of evidence out of their mind, they go to the next piece, they knock that out, and go to the next piece, they knock that out. Pretty soon they thought, there really is no evidence then. But what they failed to do, and what people fail to do when they read the story, is to put all the pieces together. The odds of all of those things, the gloves, the footprint that matches his particular Italian shoe, the fact that he ran, all those pieces together are damning. They're conclusive, but, well, you know, I'm certainly not going to be his judge. But from a standpoint of conclusive evidence, it would be pretty hard to turn that one down. And yet, people generally will take these each individually, and like when you're talking to someone about the Lord, they'll go into the yeah buts. Yeah, but, you know, and then they want to go to another point, and then you prove that point. Yeah, but what about this? And they'll go to another one. And pretty soon in their mind, they think they've handled all those things, and you've got really nothing left to say, and they've never seen the whole picture of how amazing it is. Because you've got more than just what happened here. You've got the prophecies of his coming, of that he would die. 300 distinct prophecies of what exactly would happen. That did happen. And then when it happened with the eyewitnesses' account, then the appearances of Jesus, then the changed lives of the apostles. All of those things together, really, if you understand anything about historical evidence, provide a much more solid basis for you to believe that Jesus died and rose again on the third day than any other historical thing that you can think of in antiquity. For example, you know, generally people talk about Caesar and fighting the Gallic Wars, and you know, that's a known fact in history. Well, we've got very little historical evidence to back that up. But the evidence that is there is pretty substantial. It's not near as substantial as this evidence. When you compare all the gospel accounts, when you compare all the prophecies, when you compare all the different distinct things, there is no comparison. What is true is that Jesus did come indeed as a fulfillment of the prophecies. He did die as was predicted that he would die. He rose again as he predicted. And then he appeared to the many and then ascended to the Father. And then as he promised, he sent the Holy Spirit back down, which dramatically changed the lives of the disciples. So much so that the whole world took on a whole new change as people heard and believed the gospel message and their lives were transformed. Even to this day, in this century that we live in, we believe. Because it's now, most of you probably didn't come in the door because of a very clear demonstration of this defense of the gospel. Most of you might have had other experiences. You might have cried out to God in your pain or your difficulty. You might have come to church and just seen the love and the joy here and gone, yeah, this is something really happening here. I want this. You heard a message and you believed and you received the Lord, and he's more real to you, just as John had that strong intuitive knowledge. But more than that, the experiential knowledge after Jesus appeared to them, they knew that they knew. In the same way that you know that you know that you know, he is Lord. Because he has shown himself to you. And we put our faith exactly in what he has done for us in his word. And this is really what it is. I want to leave the next part because I want to talk about the doubting Thomases next time. And how that all happens and working through our doubts and issues that we face. And how Jesus allayed those fears. But yet what he expressed to Thomas was so important. So you got to read ahead. I want you to do that. But we'll look at it when we get there next time.